Well, it's great to see the room as full as it is today. Welcome. Welcome to everyone. Welcome back to Cambridge. Welcome to the new term. Particularly warm welcome to our new students, to our visiting fellows, to good hearted professor for this year. And of course, a very warm welcome to our new Hume professor, Professor Yan. Feels a bit presumptuous to try to introduce Professor Clabbums to all of you. I assume most people here, if not Yan, the individual, then certainly Clabbers, as the author of many wonderful books and articles in international organizations law, the law of treaties, virtue ethics, global governance. Yan, Professor Clabbers can, I think, convincingly claim to have founded and redefined all of these fields in significant ways. Some of you may have also encountered Clabbers through textbooks, so Clabbers in International Law. You may have used Clabbers on international law materials. You may have used the Cambridge Companion to International Organizations Law and many other essential reference works, all of which have Professor Clabbers' authorial stamp on them. Or, and moving the needle a bit now to Yan, Professor Clabbers, you may know him from having visited Helsinki, where he spent 30 years as one of the pillars of Helsinki's fantastic international law program. And as one of the directors of the Gastron Institute, you may have gone to the summer seminar that Helsinki has been running 30 years, or indeed have had Yan as your commentator or as a mentor, or as is true for some of us, as your examiner for your doctoral thesis. But even if not, even if you haven't met Clabbers or Yan in any way so far, what is a better way to get to know a scholar, a teacher, and a colleague than to hear about from them about their work and their ideas? And so, Yan, we cannot wait. The floor is yours.
That was by far the best introduction I've ever been given. Thank you, Surabhi. I'm a bit overwhelmed by the occasion, not only by being new in town, also by standing here for a full house. Because usually when there's an announcement that someone will speak on international organizations law, there's going to be four or five people. And half of them will be sent by their supervisors. This is quite something. Thank you for showing up and showing up online, those of you who are online. I thought I'd give myself a bit of a soft landing, talking about stuff that I have been doing for the last couple of years and that I will no doubt continue to do, even formally. The research project I'm talking about will end in a few months. We all know that that's never the end of the project. At best, that's an extended beginning, right? Okay, it so happens I was in this very room in 2013 giving a talk. Surabhi was there as well. We had coffee afterwards, I remember. Talking about research as curiosity, which was a nice idea at any rate, especially in light of what funding agencies want and REFs and all that. A couple of years earlier, I was speaking at the European Society of International Law about international law organizations. I do remember the title, which was Paradise Lost, which seems rather appropriate these days. And I do remember there was really no one in the audience because next door, parallel session, Roger O'Keefe was speaking. You can imagine how that went. And in 2017, I was here again speaking. The relations between international organizations in the same. So all of those form a bit of a prelude to today. I will continue on these themes, research as curiosity, paradise lost perhaps, international organizations and the external world, by talking about my research project, Previgo. That's, you know, the ERC, the European Research Council, wants acronyms. So this is a contraction of private and intergovernmental organization. Maybe it worked to get the funding, who knows. The gist of the project is to come up with a story saying that, contrary to popular belief, international organizations are here to serve the global economy in myriad space. That also applies to research organizations, international organizations dedicated to research. The classic example from our field might be the European University Institute, which is active on the market for higher education, if nothing else. And it's an international organization, lest we forget. Few people realize that, I guess. But there are also other organizations. It was a few months ago, the wonderful, the very small but wonderful International Iberian Nanotechnology Laboratory. Should I repeat that? International Iberian Nanotechnology Laboratory, a laboratory set up as an international organization, doing stuff in the field of nanotechnology with no doubt commercial applications. Its legal counsel, at least, was pretty convinced of all that. And there are all sorts of ramifications then in the legal regulation of what such an organization does. A classic example from the case law, international organizations law, in molecular biology laboratory based in Heidelberg, not unfamiliar to some of you, I guess, and doing molecular biology. But my favorite example for the time being, you have a smartphone, most of you. You open your smartphone, but you get a touch screen that was not developed by NASA, not developed by Steve Jobs, not developed by Bill Gates. It was developed instead by CERN, the Conseil Européen pour la Recherche Nucléaire, based in Geneva, and known from the Big Bang stuff that they try to emulate. Apparently, in the early 70s, they had the problem that they needed to connect millions of computers together, couldn't figure out how where to leave the cables, and then stumbled upon the touch screen, which we now have in our smartphones. We have it at airport kiosks, railway station kiosks, vending machines, you name it. So that has had quite a commercial application. So that's the gist of where I will end up. International organizations serving the global economy. And of course, there will be exceptions, but in a world of more than 300 organizations, that's only to be expected. The starting point was a certain dissatisfaction with the state of the art of international organizations law. I grew up in the Netherlands. I did my undergrad in Amsterdam, where we were taught by Bouwet, one of the predecessors here, and my compatriot Schermers. The Schermers, nowadays Schermers Blocker, to 1,500 pages. Everything you always wanted to know about IOs, but were afraid to ask. And quite a few things you might never have realized you wanted to know. Wonderful stuff, but all of those books, Bouwet, Schermers, Seidel-Bohnwelder in German, all of those classic post-war international organization stories boil down to repeating, regurgitating, developing and finessing the law of international organizations as it had been already established around one, the writings of Paul Reinsch, Wisconsin, Frank Sayre from Harvard, who happened to be Woodrow Wilson's son-in-law. There's a story to that. So from some angles, international organizations stuck in the rut, having been developed over a century ago, has never really been reconsidered. Rethought. And all of that body of law, that whole corpus, the national relations law, as we know it, is built around a very fundamental assumption. It's an oxymoron, right? Assumptions tend to be. The vacuum assumption, as I call it, the idea that the only legally relevant relationship is that between the organization and its member states. Organization. All of the law has been developed around that relationship, disregarding internal stuff. There's a reason why there's no very little on separation of powers, for instance, in IO. And with complete benign disregard of the external world. There never was an external world. If you go back to the constitutions of the old international organizations, Postal Union, the Telegraph Union, all of those, they lacked two things. They lacked international legal personality. At least none of them had a clause. Later on, in the 90s, Chanukya Wickremesinghe, Brunnenfuss, wrote his PhD suggesting that explicit grant of legal personality only started to arise in minor versions in the late 70s, early 80s. And I think that's by and large correct. The old organizations granted international personality, at least not by their member states, leaving aside what the legal system may have said about it, but not by their member states. And by the same token, they were never given treaty-making powers. It's no coincidence that the first academic studies on treaty-making powers of international organizations of the 1950s, after the UN had been set up and started to peacekeeping demands and data to fulfill agreement, all that sort of stuff. Before that, just silence. And that suggests that organizations were set up only as extensions of member states, to serve member states at the best of member states, for member states, but no contact with the outside world, whatever envisaged. That may or may not have been accurate, guessing not, but may or may not have been accurate in the late 19th, early 20th century, when all of those creatures were set up. But surely, if you look around you, it is no longer a plausible thesis, right? International organizations only interacting with their member states. Look around you. International organizations do a lot of stuff with each other, whether it is setting up joint ventures, the World Food Program, the Codex Alimentarius Commission, or whether it is organizing a joint seminar on the relation between trade and labor, which the WTO and the ILO do on a regular basis. They interact with NGOs. Quite a few NGOs will have observer status, if nothing else, with international organizations. And some might have even more different kinds of international organizations interact and have to interact with non-member states. The drafters of the UN Charter realized that already. Article 2, paragraph 6 is a call upon non-member states to help the UN achieve its functions. And an organization like the OECD, a decade ago, adopted the Global Tax Regime Convention, which is impossible, of course, for OECD member states to do on their own. I think there are 38 of them, which leaves about 162 or so non-member states that need to be convinced, persuaded, and embraced. International organizations do stuff with cities, as my friend Helmut Aust from Berlin never ceases to point out. They do work with sports organizations, FIFA, which we may not accuse of corruption in any way, ever. With the International Olympic Committee, with the Premier League, the Bundesliga, with national football leagues, they are very keen to meet up with sustainability standards set by UNEP, for instance, which is a form of contact, again, between organizations and others, external world. And then, if only in order to sell my project to funding agency, I thought it would be good to devote attention to the sector, because that, of course, is always considered appealing, for better or worse. Hence, there we go, international organizations and the private sector. The project rests on four strands, one might say, three of them rather doctrinal, the good reason that very little has been written on the topics. I have three postdocs. The fourth strand is my own stuff. The three postdocs are still in Helsinki, will remain in Helsinki. One of them is working on funding of international organizations by the private sector. Now, what should you think of? You should think, for instance, of UNHCR. Pop quiz. Does anyone know who the biggest private sector funder of UNHCR is? It's the Commissioner for Refugees. Anyone? Any guesses? It's not Microsoft. It's not Google. It is instead Procter & Gamble. What does Procter & Gamble make? A lot of things, including diapers. There's a couple of dots in that story you may connect yourself. So funding by private actors in that, by private donations, is one way in which international organizations garner money. It's not the only way. You and I can also donate if you open up the website of UNHCR. No, not UNHCR at the moment, that went down somehow. Of IOM, for instance, International Organization for Migration. First thing you see is a button blinking saying, donate, 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 which you may or may not be tempted to do for the orderly regulation of migration worldwide. But the more interesting versions are things like public partnerships. Think of the Global Fund based in Geneva. Think of Gavi, the Alliance, as one has to call it these days. Once upon a time known as the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization. Both of them public-private partnerships, and apparently there are some so actual medical field, global health domain alone, and heavily sponsored by the CIA-based Gates Foundation. To the extent, rumor has it that if Gates wants to discuss something, the CEOs or the directors general of those organizations fly to Seattle rather than to Geneva. That must have consequences for governance of the Global Fund. That must have consequences for accountability, if any, of the Global Fund and the Gavi Alliance and all those other public-private partnerships. So one of my postdocs is figuring it out, is writing a monograph on this topic. What makes it extra appealing is that the last legal studies on financing of organization, book lengths at least, appeared in the 1960s. There's maybe about time to boost that a bit. There have been very useful article contributions, particularly by Jose Alvarez on one or two occasions. But book length studies of financing of international organizations generally have been few and far between, let alone taking the private sector into account. So that's the first strand. Second strand focuses on international organizations as market actors, because international organizations, increasingly so perhaps, also buy products. Procurement is a big thing. It happens that a few years ago, a brilliant monograph was written, Procurement, by organizations, by Elisabetta Morlino. If you have a chance, read up on that. That's your go-to book. But not much on selling by international organizations, and they do sell stuff. They might sell mugs, sell postcards at Christmas, as UNESCO, or UNICEF, I think, or UNESCO as well. At least they did that when I was a kid. I remember going around my neighborhood and trying to get money and hand it over to my teacher in the hope that it would end up. But they also do more. WIPO makes roughly 97% of its budget by selling patent-related services, or so I'm told. The IOM, International Organization for Migration, makes a similar percentage of its budget by providing migration-related services. It can be anything from designing airports. If you ever go to Yerevan, Armenia, the local airport there was designed by IOM people. And you get claustrophobic when you arrive there, also because you arrive at 3 in the morning, because the flights arrive late. So you're sort of in tune with claustrophobia. But it's designed in such a way that there is a single path to follow, no escape, no nothing. It's for the orderly regulation of migration. This is how IOM money. And 25 years ago, it became rather notorious for running migration detention centers on behalf of Australia, doing Australian dirty work, one might whisper. I cannot say that out loud, but one could whisper it, perhaps. And that was how the IOM made ends meet. So again, that raises questions, accountability, governance, all that sort of stuff. So my second post looking into that was buying and the selling of goods. You still with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, postdoc number three, take the cues from COVID. You may recall COVID not that long ago. The Director General of the World Health Organization declared a pandemic, a public health emergency of international concern around February 2020. It took about 3 weeks for the first airline to go bankrupt. You could say contingency, coincidence. You could also say, well, maybe there's a bit of a causal link there, because declaring a pandemic may have consequences. Looking back, that was even better visible. But COVID also made it quite visible. Jeff Bezos made a killing. Whereas restaurants and hotels, bars and mom and pop stores lost out, right? No coincidence. In 2009, swine flu broke out, which also was that a pandemic. Some companies, some pharmaceuticals had their vaccines ready. They were cheering WHO on. Others would later complain that the World Health Organization declared the pandemic too early because they didn't have their vaccines ready yet. Now, what does that tell you again? That the decisions of international organizations can have distributive or redistributive consequences. So that raises a bunch of questions. Your examples galore, of course. Think of UNESCO declaring World Heritage Site. That's good for project developers if they already have a foot in the door. That's not good for other project developers who might complain that the process was skewed or whatever. But clearly, there is something going on there, which then also involves lobbying, which involves access of companies to international organizations, to decision-making fora. It may not surprise you to hear that the Universal Postal Union, a venerable institution, going back 50 years, 51 as we speak, was contemplating a few years ago to open membership not only for states, but also for FedEx, UPS, and Amazon. What does that tell you? Again, connections to be drawn. So that's the third postdoc. And my own stuff then is putting all this together and modestly thinking that maybe it's time to reconsider international organizations law a bit. You know the traditional story about international organizations law, right? That goes back to the writings of Kazansky around the turn of the 19th century, to Georg Jelinek, 1880, Einsch, 1980, Frank Zehr, 1919. I think that was sort of the finishing touch, if you will. The traditional story, but F word, other F word, function, is that international organizations are invariably set up by states that are otherwise nasty. You know, on Monday they invade, on Tuesday they commit torture, on Wednesday they genocide, on Thursday they see the light and set up, do an HCR, and on Friday back to business, right? They're there to do good in the world. Public ethos, a mission. They're apolitical, they're principal agent structures, with the principle, the collective principle, telling the agent, the organization, what to do, the delegated powers and functions, and they're here eventually for the salvation of mankind, as Nagendra Singh once put it. And those of you who know your classics will know that a bit later in life, Nagendra Singh became president of the International Court of Justice. So not just anyone, right? Salvation of mankind to be left to Jesus Christ and the Universal Postal Union. That should work quite nicely. Maybe it's not a very plausible story, because first of all, why would nasty states all of a sudden see the light and then all of a sudden have it switched off again? Why would they want to do good through international organizations? So that alone would be a reason to at least question that classic story. But second, if you look a bit closer, the creation of many organizations, notice often enough behind that was not so much, but doing something for particular groups of actors. My favorite example, well, one of my favorite examples, collected quite a few by now, is that of the creation of the International Copyright Union, the 1880s, because France, Denmark started to create world peace by copyright protection. That was because Victor Hugo, the novelist, heard of him, right? Hunchback of Notre Dame, Les Misérables, still on show in London, I guess. That Victor Hugo had this idea as president of the Association Littéraire et Artistique Internationale, an NGO, if you will, pressure group of people in the arts. He was a bit upset that whenever he wrote a piece for Le Figaro or Le Monde, he would get a flat fee, a couple of hundred francs, and that was it. Once the piece was published, everyone could take it away. Everyone could run with it. Everyone could publish it, redo it, translate it, and he wouldn't see a single sou anymore. Opera writers had the same encounter with then existing intellectual property or absence of intellectual property. So the Association Littéraire et Artistique Internationale, spearheaded by Victor Hugo, started to nag the French government to do something about it, not just domestically, but also internationally, because the translations would be a nice little extra for Victor and his comrades. And thus, the International Copyright Union was born. It's still with us, different name, having gone through a couple of reincarnations. It's now the WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, which does more than copyright, but still. You can tell similar stories about the Universal Postal Union, someone had figured out in the middle of the 19th century. There were 1,200 different ways, 1,200, give or take, sending letters and parcels throughout Europe. Take particular routes, the value could be measured, or the cost could be measured by weight, by size, by content, by route, by 1,200. And you can imagine that's not very business, right? You cannot be sure when the contract offer arrives. You cannot be sure whether it arrives, and the cost of sending something alone might have been prohibitive. So in order to streamline that, in order to harmonize that, the American Postmaster General, that's a serious post US administration, that's like a ministerial function. The Postmaster General at the time, Montgomery Blair, came up with this idea of harmonizing that, making sure that throughout the world, or at least bits and pieces of the world that were considered to matter, throughout that world, that there would be far more elegant, simple, and economical scheme for doing those things. It took a while, the Franco-Prussian War intervened, but by 1874, postal convention was concluded, setting up a small national organization. And so it goes, so it goes, so it goes, so it goes. So, in the end, one can distinguish perhaps, or can make the point perhaps, that international organizations, activities, the law governing them, if any, tends to follow developments in global economic thinking. It's a bit of a bold proposition, and I may stand corrected at some point. But for the time being, one can probably distinguish four different stages. First is that coinciding with the emergence of the trading nation in the 1850s, 1860s, with the first wave. Well, historians differ as to when globalization started and whether there were earlier waves, but with a pretty significant wave of globalization in the second half of the 19th century. First stage would be the period 1815 to 1914, where essentially many organizations were set up to provide economic infrastructures. Harmonization of postal, the harmonization of telegraph management, the telegraph union, the beautiful Bureau International de Poids et Mesures, figuring out how much is a meter. It's wonderful in Paris at their headquarters, there is a specimen of a meter which every decade or so has to be recalibrated because of heat and cold and other influences. So it may differ a couple of millimeters from one decade to the next, and then it has to be redone. But the meter is a meter. And imagine how useful that is for trade and commerce. That was set up in 1875, so exactly 150 years ago. It also has a specimen of a kilo. Undercover, because obviously if dust lands on it, it's no longer a kilo, right? So the kilo point 0000 something. So again, very useful for commerce. Not much to do immediately with world peace, perhaps. With world commerce, yes. Because this means that if you buy a kilo, let's say 10 kilos, let's make it grander, 10 kilos of potatoes from Belgium, you'd get the same amount of potatoes as if you'd buy them from Germany, right? You would not have to deal with local measures, local standards, which was the case before then. That's a very old idea, by the way. Those of you who've read the Magna Carta will realize that it's already there, that the guys who sponsored the Magna Carta thought it would be very good to have standardized measures for cloth, ale, and wine, the important stuff. So there we are. That was the first stage. And that went from telegraph and port to railways. Imagine that railways need to be harmonized, because otherwise, if you have different rules in different countries, different track widths, it becomes very difficult. Even the glorious International Institute for Refrigeration was back to it. And refrigeration had just been invented. That too required harmonization. Okay, so that's the first stage. The second stage would be the interbellum. It's the historian Patricia Clayton has labeled very nicely as the period of securing the world economy, which I think is just about right, setting up the league with all social economic stuff. The League of Nations usually considered a failure when it comes to peace and security, but it did a lot of other stuff as well. Bill Clary today. The ILO set up level the playing field, perhaps, when it comes to labor relations. And even the World Organization for Animal Health set up 1924 to combat the Rinderpest, cattle plague, which is a big thing, of course, for farmer. And if you're dependent on cattle for your income, in a country like Argentina, for instance, you can fill in the list. World War II was a rude interruption. Third stage then, from 1945 onwards, dominated by John Maynard Keynes, him of King's College around the corner. Those were the years of interventionism in economic thinking, but also in international organizations. Witness the creation of UNCTAD, on the theories developed by Roel Prebisch and André Gundafrank, the dependencia theories. Witness the creation of UNIDO, along similar lines, the commodities organizations trying to stabilize the markets for a whole bunch of primary products. Think of the new international economic order in 1974. Ironically, this is a couple of dots I still need to connect better. But it may be the case that the new international economic order inaugurated the fourth, still current, neoliberal phase 3 years after the new international economic order resolution. Henry Kissinger, you heard of him, right? Former Nobel Peace Prize laureate. I can only wonder who the current one coming will be. I think that's today, right? Is it already? It's not Trump?
No.
Okay. That ends my chances of ever entering the US again. Maybe. Different problem at the moment. Okay. Now, Kissinger in 1977 announced the US withdrawal from the International Labor Organization, basically by proclaiming that the ILO had become too interventionist, too political, did not meet up to its original mission anymore. It's a wonderfully evocative six-page letter. You can find it in a contemporary issue of the International Legal Materials from the 1777, I guess. And it can be read as a pretty direct response to the proclamation of the new international economic order. Once that gained the majority, like, oh, careful now. We don't want that to happen. So the fourth stage still with us is characterized by the emergence of informal organizations, networks, what have you, all adopting Nike's classic slogan, just do it. And you just do it, don't interfere, right? It inaugurates the creation of those public-private partnerships that I mentioned earlier, the recent creatures. Within organizations, there have been many that have adopted new public management techniques, which we usually associate with luminaries like Margaret Thatcher. Someone from UNESCO told me so long ago, some of my legal service, that if he needs a document translated, a UNESCO document, he has to pay the translation service of UNESCO because that's proper bookkeeping. And of course, in the business world, it might well be. But in an international organization, that sort of thing might not be all that appropriate. But anyway, there's a big chunk of things like that, little bits and pieces of international organizations, either using private parties for fundraising, calling themselves, modeling themselves on private companies. The GEF, the Global Environment Facility, is an example, which does not have a director general, does not have a secretary general, it has a chief executive officer. And the language alone evokes something. Okay, so much for that. That's what I'm working on, and no doubt it will take me another half decade or more to connect those dots properly. But I'm having a lot of fun in the meantime. So to end, to satisfy my sponsors, we have a bunch of deliverables. Journal articles have come out by various team members. Two edited volumes in the pipeline. One should come out this month, actually. International Organizations Engaging the World, which provides an overview of the sort of actors that international organizations engage with. The second one, I just received the reviews from the publisher. And the reviews will be called International Organizations Facilitating Markets. Then we have the four monographs, two journal symposia coming out, International Organizations Law Review and Public Journal of International Law. And that's about it, I guess. I think I've overstepped the limits of the time to me, probably not terribly much. So, Surabhi, back to you.